Radio reports a new array of solar panels installed there will be dedicated this afternoon.
The park installed almost 3,000 solar panels, not where lots of visitors will be noticing them, but in and around the park's maintenance yard. The system is connected to the power grid, and park rangers say it'll reduce the amount of electricity Yosemite National Park uses by 12%. The nearly $6 million project just got up and running. Senator Dianne Feinstein and the media will get a first look at the fully functional project at today's ceremony. For NPR News, I'm Brandon Ridderman.
UNICEF has launched an emergency vaccination program in Kenya. The aim is to vaccinate 300,000 children who've evacuated there from drought-stricken Somalia. I'm Craig Windham, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from U.S. Oncology, united to advance cancer research with more than 200 active clinical trials. Online at usoncology.com.
Programs on WILL are made possible by Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, offering pinch-proof doors, keyless digital entries, and lifetime manufacturer warranties. Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, serving businesses and families with professionally installed doors and automatic openers since 1959 in Ogden, Illinois.
Good morning and welcome to Focus, our morning talk program. I'm David Inge. Today's first hour comes from the Focus Archives. So as you listen, keep in mind that we will not be taking calls. When you hear the name Webster, no doubt you think of the dictionary. And indeed, the first dictionary of American English was Webster's. It was published in 1828. And while most people will be familiar with that book, few Americans know much of anything about its creator. This morning, in this hour of Focus, we'll be exploring the life of Noah Webster. He was an educator, lawyer, author, newspaper man, and also statesman. And our guest is Joshua Kendall. He's author of a newly published biography, which is titled The Forgotten Founding Father, Noah Webster's Obsession and the Creation of an American Culture. Putnam is the publisher. And indeed, the book tells the story of Webster's part in establishing the cultural climate of the early republic, in part because of the dictionary, also because of a book that he put together and that was used for countless Americans to learn how to spell and to read. And Mr. Kendall, hello.
Hi there. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Well, thanks for talking with us. We certainly appreciate it. And I know as you talk about, Noah Webster, at the very beginning, you often, I think, have to make the point that, in fact, it was Noah and not his cousin, Daniel, who was the guy who put together the dictionary.
Yes. Daniel didn't write the dictionary, and that's news to a lot of people. Daniel was an eloquent senator from Massachusetts, where I live. He also was a secretary of state. And here in Massachusetts, after his death, he's become a dictionary maker. And with my book, I wanted to make two big points. One was that it was Noah, not Daniel, who wrote the dictionary. And two, that Noah wasn't just a word nerd, that he gave us our American language, true, but he also helped give us our American political identity. And that's also been a story that's been forgotten. And particularly in the 1780s, he was a key figure in helping to set up our national government and helping to get the Constitution passed. And that's something that I really wanted to impress upon readers, as well as his first name.
And for people who are not that familiar with him, I think they might be surprised to know that in his time, he was very well known. He was probably as famous in his time as was someone like, for example, George Washington.
Yes. When Noah Webster dies in 1843, he's known all across the country. One historian in the mid-19th century said that he belongs in America's Trinity of Fame, along with Washington and Columbus. And I refer to his incredible shrinking reputation. In the 1850s, Daniel is at the height of his career as a senator, and then Webster, as you mentioned in the intro, his speller, and that's really what most people knew him by. So he publishes that in 1783, and that book teaches five generations of American school kids how to read. So throughout the 19th century, for most Americans, reading is connected with Noah Webster. But that ends about 1900, and that's when his reputation starts to sink. And in 1911, Ambrose Bierce, who was a satirist who wrote the Devil's Dictionary, defines hell as the eternal resting place of the late Dr. Noah Webster dictionary maker. And I think the point of my book is to bring him back out of hell and to show Americans that he was a very colorful and brilliant figure who's really central to our sense of national identity.
Yeah, I'm sure that we'll talk more about the speller, but I think that one sort of fact is so remarkable about this book. As you said, it was first published in 1783 and then went out of print in 1900. So that's a pretty long run. But this book sold millions of copies, and apparently in his lifetime, the only thing that sold more copies than his speller was the Bible.
Yes. I refer to it as the Harry Potter of its day, a stupendous bestseller. And another interesting fact about that is that Webster was a brilliant marketer, and he built the infrastructure of the modern publishing industry, that very industry that's now threatened by the digital world. So in 1783, when the book comes out, and it's in its first year, it sold 5,000 copies, and that was in a country of 3 million, so it was a huge. He went on a national book tour. He got blurbs. He tried to get a blurb from Washington, but Washington declined. But he got one and ended up getting one from Franklin. And he really knew how to sell books. And in America, the dictionary business has been just that, a business, whereas in Europe, dictionaries were formed by committee, like in France or Italy. And we really needed someone with Webster's business savvy, which he developed as he was selling the speller, to come up with a dictionary. And if Webster hadn't done it in the early 1800s, it might have taken quite a bit longer for us to have a national dictionary.
Yeah. And something else that it's certainly worth mentioning is that as in that time, as in this, unauthorized copying and distribution of printed material was certainly an issue, and that Webster had a lot to do with the first copyright laws for the United States.
Yes, that's another one of his achievements. And Webster was so full of achievements, any of the achievements that I'm listing here, you know, would be a lifetime's work for anyone else. But another thing that you're really putting your finger on is that he's the father of copyright law. So in 1783, the book comes out, and he's concerned about piracy. So he personally travels to every single state capital and networks with the leading politicos and gets copyright law passed because there was no central government. And what's also interesting is that Webster was an arch federalist, and several years later he works with Washington. He sees Washington at the Constitutional Convention, and he's there, and he helps get the Constitution passed. And he's delighted because he's an arch federalist and he wants America to be unified. But he also has his eyes on the prize, and the day the Constitution is passed, is ratified by New Hampshire in June of 1788, he writes his publisher and says, I'm going to be able to sell more copies of my speller. So he also cashes in on the Constitution, because once the Constitution is passed, copyright law is a federal issue, not a state issue. And he signs a bunch of blockbuster book contracts over the next couple of decades. And those blockbuster book contracts give him the cash to do what he always wanted to do, which was to write the dictionary. Mm. Samuel Johnson, who wrote the Great British Dictionary, once said, "No one but a blockhead ever wrote except for money." But Webster was the opposite. He made his money with the speller, and then at the age of 40, he moves to New Haven and settles down to spend the next 30 years writing his American dictionary.
As an individual, it sounds as if he would be difficult. He certainly would have been a hard man to like. He turned a lot of people off personally, had maybe had odd aspects to his personality. But I think you also argue that had those things not been the case, had he not been the person that he was, that he probably would not have done the work that he did.
Yes. Webster was very crotchety. Another reason for his declining reputation is that historians didn't like him. And one historian said he was thinking of writing a biography, but he hated him too much. He would say ridiculous things. When he turns 50, he says no one under 45 should be allowed to vote. And I argue that he had a form of mental illness, as did Samuel Johnson, by the way. Samuel Johnson, people say today, say had Tourette syndrome. Webster, I argue, had obsessive-compulsive personality disorder. He loved control, he loved order, and he loved lists. But as you were highlighting, this pathology actually was a perfect fit for the task at hand. And if he hadn't been so obsessive, he would never have had the energy to spend 30 years writing the dictionary. And I think that it's hard to write a book about someone that people don't like and about someone that you as the author don't like. But as I got to know him and I realized that he just had a couple of marbles loose, and once I realized that, he kind of became lovable and he became understandable. And I make a comparison between Webster and the Boston Red Sox baseball player Manny Ramirez, who was a Hall of Fame caliber player, and he would do ridiculous things, and the sports writers would say, "Well, that's just Manny being Manny." And I think if you think of Noah Webster as just doing some ridiculous things, but he really also was a 300 hitter and a great lexicographer. And his particular quirks were well suited to the tasks, to his daily tasks of organizing and compiling words.
Our guest in this hour is Joshua Kendall. He's a journalist. He is author of a newly published biography of Noah Webster. The title of his book is The Forgotten Founding Father and is published by Putnam. He is also the author of a book about Roget, the man who made the thesaurus, and in fact talked about that with our Celeste Quinn a few years ago. That interview is on our website. It's part of our web archive. If you'd like to go back and listen to that, you can. Questions here are welcome to 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455, and you can also send us an email, will-talk@illinois.edu. As a young man, he went to Yale, and I think probably people should not think of Yale as it is now. It was a different sort of a place, but it was one of the important institutions of higher learning at the time. It was not easy for his family to send him there because it was not a wealthy family. They actually had to mortgage the farm to be able to send him to Yale. What was his interest in pursuing higher education at that time?
Webster, as a kid, was very influenced by the local pastor. Pastors were then like towering figures in a community. Webster grew up in West Hartford, and the pastor was a Princeton grad who was very eloquent. Webster liked him. The pastor tutored him, and Webster then asked his father to send him to Yale. And Yale, America's colleges, we had about eight colleges, most of the Ivy League colleges, and then places like William and Mary. But America's colleges in the colonial period a place like Yale was like a Bible college. It wasn't a major research university the way Oxford or Cambridge or Edinburgh was in the day. But still, Yale had a tremendous influence on him, and it opened up so many doors. It was maybe more like a prep school. He learned Latin and Greek, and he had four siblings, and his brothers became poor farmers, and they just didn't have the options that he had. But right after Yale, the contacts that he made, it just opened up a whole new world for him. That said, he couldn't get a job when he finished, because he finishes in 1778, and the economy is tanking. We're in the middle of a revolutionary war, and the only job he could get was one as a school teacher, and school teachers today don't get a fair shake, and then it was even worse. It was a job for convicts and drunks, and Webster taught school kids, but that job ended up giving him the platform to write The Speller, because he saw that the spelling book that he was using, by a Brit named Dilworth, wasn't that user-friendly. And even though Webster had a hard time connecting with other human beings, he could always connect with readers on the page. And he devised this new book, which was very user-friendly and also was very American. Rather than using British examples, it used American examples. And that really was the beginning of, he's forming his legacy. And his legacy is to give us the American language. With The Speller in 1783 and The Dictionary in 1828, these two books give us American English. We're the most we're the most ethnically diverse nation on the face of the earth, but from Maine to Hawaii, we all speak the same language. We can understand each other. Whereas in old Europe, in England or France or Germany or Italy, every 20 kilometers, they speak a different dialect. But Webster's Yale education gave him a broad background in the humanities, and he loved reading and writing, and it also allowed him to achieve this towering accomplishment, which is to give us a national language.
Yeah, I don't think that you can underestimate what it meant that for all of those years between 1783 and 1900, all over the country, children in school were using this same book to learn to read and to spell, and that for people all over the country, if they had reference books on their shelf, the dictionary would have been one. And not only did regular folks use it, but people of American letters used it.
Yes. About the speller, what I found incredible is that the Southerners during the Civil War loved the speller. The Boston Athenaeum, a private library here in Boston that's kind of a sister organization to the Newbery Library in Chicago, has the world's best collection of Confederate imprints. And during the Civil War, there were special spellers, Webster spellers, that were, quote, changed for the present condition. Spellers had sample sentences, and in the edition in New England, it said the president's term is 4 years. In the edition printed in Macon, Georgia in 1862, it said the president's term is 6 years, because that's the way it was in the Confederacy. So even though Southerners wanted to kill us, they still wanted their kids to learn English the Noah Webster way. And that brings up the whole question, which is really outside of my knowledge, but the question of, what unites us as Americans. We do have the same language, but there's still a lot of debate. There's a lot of fierce anger between states and between parts of the country, but we are still united by one language, and we've always been united by one language, even during the Civil War.
Yeah. What's also interesting, I think, is, as you point out, is that previous spellers, those kinds of books that had been used in school, had this very heavy sort of moral religious component in the kind of examples and the sentences that they had in there that the children would learn as a way of learning spelling and grammar and reading. The Webster, the blueback speller, he took all of that out, but what he substituted was stuff about patriotism and about American values. And so it became, in addition to something that would teach reading and writing and grammar, it also had that kind of message buried in the text.
Yeah, Webster was a bundle of contradictions, and the point that you make is an excellent one, that the speller, he wanted to take out the religion, and that's one of the reasons it really caught on. But in terms of his contradictions, in 1808 he becomes a born again Christian. That was common among New Englanders with the Second Great Awakening, and so when it comes time to write the dictionary, he tries to stuff religion down people's throats, and he'll define marriage as a covenant between man, woman, and God in 1828. So he's sort of a bundle of contradictions, and sometimes he does something that absolutely right, and other times he'll fall back into exactly the opposite of what he did years earlier.
Yeah. That's also this his turn to religion had an impact on the writing of the dictionary, because it sent him down a road that it turned out to be the wrong road, but he spent many years going down that road trying to support an argument about where language came from that would fit in with a very strict interpretation of the Bible, something that even at the time, people who looked at language and how it developed felt was completely wrong. But he spent years and years on that, and that was incorporated in the dictionary. Later, it ended up being taken out. But it was something that you say really took him off track and probably cost him several years that he would have been working on the dictionary when he was working on this.
Yes, Webster was very arrogant, and he always thought he knew everything. And often that pathology was helpful. I mean, he it gave him the energy to write the dictionary. But you're alluding to one instance where his grandiosity got him into trouble. So he starts the dictionary, the big dictionary, in around 1807, and after the first year he has this religious conversion. And then he decides that all languages can be traced back to the language of his biblical namesake, Noah, from Noah's Ark. So he wants to write the mother of all etymologies. And he spends 10 years on this etymology, and he's not listening to anyone else. He thinks he knows everything, and there's no evidence. You know, there's no one checking his evidence, and he has these speculations. One speculation proves another speculation, and he spends 10 years, and he writes a 1,000-page etymology that today gathers dust in the New York Public Library, and he sticks in some of these funny etymological ideas in the 1828 dictionary. And his lone assistant on the dictionary, a Yale medical student named James Percival, is up on his etymology, and he knows German, and at that time the Germans are making some serious inroads into etymology. And during the and Percival sees this faulty etymology in around 1826 when he's doing some copy editing, 1827, and he writes a friend, "Multa absurda removi." He's so angry, he says, "Many absurd things I've removed." And he tries to take out the bogus etymology, and Webster, of course, is furious, and he fires him. Again, this is an instance where his headstrong temperament didn't work to his advantage, but in many cases it did, and he wouldn't have written so many books, and not just the dictionary and the speller, but he wrote a 700-page treatise on public health, and he had so many, and he wrote a bestseller like in the manner of Paul Richards' Almanac. So he was such an avid writer and a really good one, but this etymology was one wrong turn that he took. And in my biography, I'm just trying to evaluate Webster critically, but also just reasonably, and say, well, this was great and this wasn't so great. But traditionally, especially with the founding fathers, historians have idealized these figures. And you know, one biographer in the 1930s says that the etymology had some useful results. And I just think that's just not true. And I think Webster was a great man. James Murray, the editor of the OED, once said, you know, he was a great man. The OED, the Oxford English Dictionary, he was a great man, a born definer of words. And I agree with that. But there were some flaws in his oeuvre, and the major flaw was in this etymology that he was so proud of.
Our guest in this hour, Focus, Joshua Kendall. We're talking about the life of Noah Webster. He writes about that life in his recent book, The Forgotten Founding Father. It's published by Putnam. And again, questions are certainly welcome. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. Something I want to have you talk a little bit more about is Webster and his father. And I guess the thing I'm just thinking of is that while on one hand the father did what he had to do to make it possible for Noah to go to Yale, that also the story is that when Noah graduated, his father handed him a couple of dollars and said, "Well, here you go, son. Good luck." And that was it. That was the last he really had to do with his family.
Yeah, it's a very moving section of his memoir when he records that event. So he's about 20. He finishes Yale, and he wants to be a writer. He just loves reading and writing. He had a bunch of buddies that he would hang out with and talk about ideas, and he decides he wants to be a writer. The problem is it's 1778. The economy is tanking. In those days, every state is printing its own money, and the money's all worthless. Connecticut, where he's living, is printing $60, $70, $80 bills. His father gives him an $8 bill, which is basically worthless, and says, "Son, you're on your own now." And Webster immediately goes into his room and starts reading Samuel Johnson. He reads Samuel Johnson's Moral Essays. And as he writes in his diary, he felt cast upon the world, but then he sort of vows to himself that, "I'm going to be like Samuel Johnson when I grow up." And, you know, he does just that. And Samuel Johnson becomes sort of his spiritual father. And he never really was close to his family, but after that relationship, his relations with his family were pretty strained. but Samuel Johnson becomes his father figure. But what's fascinating about that is that he has kind of a love-hate relationship with Johnson. He loves him, he loves the dictionary, he loves the moral essays, but he also wants to replace Johnson. And he's constantly criticizing Johnson and saying that every page of his dictionary is full of errors. So he's got this kind of curious relationship. But Webster was always the guy who felt closer to words than to people. As they argued that he had, you know, this obsessive-compulsive personality disorder, and one of the features of that is a lot of interpersonal anxiety. And again, he didn't have close relationships with his parents. He ended up marrying and having seven children, but I think he always still felt closer to words, and he put sand in his room. And I think one of the attractions of the dictionary for him was perhaps an escape from his family. He always had something to do in his sand-line room, and he was pleasant with his children, but he would give them lectures, and it seemed like he was a tough guy to be around. I did a piece for Psychology Today about obsessive-compulsive personality disorder, and I spoke with contemporary therapists, and they say that that people with that disorder rarely go into treatment. If someone like a Webster, they find an outlet for their obsessionality, they do just fine, but they're the type of people who drive other family members into treatment. So yeah. Therapists say they have a lot of people who had a father with obsessive-compulsive disorder or maybe a husband. So he was just a difficult guy, but again, those quirks enabled him to do the dictionary.
And when you say he put sand in his room, we're talking about the stuff that you find on the beach, right?
Yeah.
And it was because it made it more quiet?
Exactly. I have a sense that the noise of the children really bothered him, and that he was sort of in his own little cocoon to do his dictionary. And I think the etymology also, the 10 years that he worked on that, were the critical sort of child-rearing years. And I just have a sense that he was really overwhelmed by, you know, kids. He had six girls. They're all adolescents and chattering. And I have a sense that some of the letters to the girls are a little heartbreaking because he's giving them little lectures, and they're kind of shaming themselves. Oh, Daddy, I'm ugly. And he really didn't know how to relate to other people. And I think that his study was sort of his heaven on earth, and he had a beautiful house in New Haven. He moved into the fanciest house in New Haven, one that used to be owned by Benedict Arnold, the trader, and he got a good deal because of the shame associated with the house, and he put, again, sand in the walls and went to work on the dictionary.
Our guest in this hour is Joshua Kendall, and he is the author of The Forgotten Founding Father. It is a biography of Noah Webster. We have a caller here, someone in Effingham. We'll go right there to our line four. Hello.
Yes, thank you, David, for taking my call. A great show, or a great program, I should say. I'm wondering if your guest's research had taken him to a broader field other than Webster, where language had already existed and written language would have been part of the evolution, and what was going on in other cultures, both East and West, and how that played into Webster's searches and his passion. Thank you. I'll hang up and listen.
That is a rather broad question. Yes. I don't know if you can address
that. Rather broad question. It sounds like you might need a whole team of experts to answer it. I can maybe just compare a little bit about East and West is really huge, but just the status of dictionaries in other Western countries.
Mm-hmm.
As I said, in England, the first major English dictionary is 1721. I also might say that spelling in English was a jumble until around 1700. 1721, you have the first English dictionary by a guy named Nathaniel Bailey. And then you have Johnson's dictionary in 1755, and that was really Webster's base. About a third of the definitions were taken from Johnson. And then Webster adds a lot of strictly scientific terms during the Enlightenment. And then there are also, you know, as I was alluding to earlier, the French and Spanish and Italian, and they had national committees. And Webster does take a trip to Europe and spend some time in Paris looking at European dictionaries. And they tended to be by committee as opposed to the one-man shows by Webster and Johnson. About the question of oral and written language, again, that's a huge question, and I don't think it was, you know, that really goes back, millennia, and that's really a tough one for me to weigh in on.
Right. One other thing that just brings to mind, this is a little bit different, but it has to do with how people at the time were thinking about language that I found really quite interesting, that at the time of the Revolution, or perhaps right after the Revolution, there were some people that thought the language of the United States, of the new America, should be something other than English. And they talked about a number of different things, and apparently the thinking was, well, English is the language of the enemy. These are the people we just threw off, so perhaps we're having a new country here. Maybe we should be thinking about adopting some other language.
Yes. There was a serious debate in that because, as I tend to put it, you know, English was the language, you know, of the oppressor. I mean, we had just, you know, fought a war to get King George out of our face, and now do we want to speak the king's English? And really, Webster ended that debate with the speller, and as part of the debate, there was a serious movement to have us speaking German. German was then, like Spanish today, language number two, spoken by about 10% of the population. A lot of documents were translated into German. You know, when the Constitution is passed or something, it's going to be translated into German right away, like a document might be translated into Spanish today. And there's even a famous story about someone in Boston who said, maybe Americans should start speaking ancient Hebrew, or just doing what the Israelis did, because we're a new country and everything was up for grabs. And Webster had a very reasonable solution to the problem. Let's speak American English. And he said, we don't need the license of an Englishman for our words. So in his American Dictionary, he's not only going to add a lot of scientific terms, he's also going to add a lot of distinctly American terms like squash, things that, and he's going to also define American terms, like Constitution means something very different in American English than in British English. And the fascinating thing about the dictionary is that Americans didn't really see a need for it. Webster had a kind of personal need for it. He loved organizing and compiling words, but Americans loved Samuel Johnson. He was considered the established order. And as I wrote in a piece for the Globe on Johnson's 300th birthday, that's the Boston Globe, Johnson actually hated Americans. He once said, I'm willing to love all mankind except an American. He thought we were a bunch of hypocrites. You know, we yelp for freedom and we have slaves. But Americans were addicted to Johnson, and they didn't see any reason for an American dictionary. And this is an instance where Webster's hard-headedness, his grandiosity, came in handy, because only someone with his obsessionality would have spent 30 years on a book that no one really wanted. But, of course, after it was published, Americans saw the need for it and were really appreciative. But in the 1820s, people had very little interest in Webster, but he did have the persistence to stick it out, and the reviews were fantastic. And Americans then really began to appreciate what he had done.
Yeah. When one sets out to write a dictionary, if you're an individual, this is a golden opportunity for you to put your own particular spin on the definitions. And if you're intent on making some particular point, and many people have done that, they have written books that were called dictionaries, and that they used it to make particular points. That gives you the opportunity to do that. The book, your book, Forgotten Founding Father, each chapter begins with an entry from his dictionary, which I think gives you just at least a little bit of a taste of how idiosyncratic his dictionary entries are and how they are really about where you can, by reading them, you can learn something about him. It says something about him. Can you talk a little bit more about that and about how much of himself and his way of looking at things and what he thought was important end up in the dictionary as part of the definitions of the words?
Yes. Back in the day of the one-man bands, dictionaries were in part autobiographies. Johnson didn't like being a dictionary maker. As I said before, he did it for the money. So he defines lexicographer as a harmless drudge. Webster loved being a lexicographer, and he's going to be much more analytic in his definition. There's a funny story about Webster where Webster has a love affair when he's about 20. He wants to marry a woman named Rebecca. She was married before to a soldier, but then the soldier suddenly comes back. They thought the soldier was dead, and Webster loses out. And 100 years later, Saturday Review quips, well, we don't know what Webster really thought about this. It must have taken him a whole dictionary to express his feelings. It's just the sense that he's constantly expressing himself in the dictionary. There'll be personal examples. He lived in Western Massachusetts in Amherst for a while, so he'll have examples from Amherst. One of the major things that he does is he tries, as I said earlier, to bring in his Christian beliefs. There's an age-old dispute in lexicography about whether lexicographers should describe language as it is or prescribe language, whether they should tell readers how language ought to be used or how language actually is used. Webster was a descriptivist. His definitions told people how words are used. Well, what's fascinating about the 1828 dictionary is that he was prescriptive in terms of telling people how to live. So he would have a lot of religious examples, and that's part of his autobiography. So you learn about how Webster thought about sex as a young man, he raced around with the fast crowd at Yale, but later he became kind of a prig. So you learn about Webster through those definitions, and then he's always sticking events in from his life. One of his daughters dies at about 20, and he sticks her in one of the definitions about loss. That also was the case with Peter Mark Roget. I wrote this book about the making of a thesaurus, and also in the age of the one-man band, these reference books are autobiographical. And Roget, like Webster, hated dirt, and one of the longest entries in the thesaurus are synonyms for dirt. Because that's what he was obsessed by. So these personal obsessions work their way in to the reference books. And the first modern English dictionary that wasn't autobiographical is the 1864 edition of Webster's. Webster's dies in 1843. The Merriams come in a few years later, and they publish a major revision in 1864. And that would be the first dictionary that's objective. That dictionary was the product of the Yale faculty. The Yale faculty then had about 30 members. About half of them worked together to put out this dictionary, and that's the first one that's not going to have autobiographical references, and it's going to be objective. So that's the first dictionary that you could go to and get a neutral definition of a word. But Webster's is going to be full of his pet peeves, and it's all over the place.
We have about 10 minutes left in this hour of Focus. The Forgotten Founding Father, that's the book we're talking about. It's a biography of Noah Webster, the man who created the first American dictionary and also created a book that was used by countless American schoolchildren from the 1700s right up to 1900, used in schools for them to learn how to spell and to learn grammar and to learn how to read. And the book makes the argument, Joshua Kendall makes the argument, that those two things would have been enough. And there were other things that Webster did, but just those two things would have been enough to make him very influential in creating, solidifying a kind of national culture for America in its early years. The book's out now. If you want to look at it, questions are welcome. We have someone here ready to go in Champaign. This is line one. Hello.
Oh, is this
yes.
Am I the one?
Yes. Oh. Yes, sir.
I have a small, trivial question for your guest. I once heard this anecdote about Noah Webster, no idea whether it's true, that he was his wife caught him kissing the parlor maid. And she said, "Mr. Webster, I am surprised. And he said, no, my dear, you are astonished. I have been surprised. And I'm curious to know whether there's anything to that, whether your guest thinks it is entirely apocryphal or rather typical of Webster's attitude, whether it's one of those the Italians would call si non è vero, e ben trovato. If it isn't true, it's well invented.
Yes, I think that's accurate. I think that I've heard that anecdote many times and seen it in many places. I haven't, you know, I went to about 20 archive libraries, mostly up and down the East Coast from Massachusetts to Washington, D.C., and I couldn't find the smoking gun. I couldn't find a letter backing up that story. And I think that story is, and also about his womanizing, I have a sense that when he was young, he was a womanizer. They're actually, he was at the Constitutional Convention, and there's some notes in his diary when he's with Benjamin Franklin, spent the evening with Dr. Franklin and the ladies. So something was probably, you know, going on before he was married. They said he ran around with a fast crowd, but after he was married, he had a reputation for being very prudish, and I don't know if it would have been true. And that anecdote is also just trying to capture his defining. And I think that's really what he was great at, that Samuel Johnson had a literary sensibility, but Webster had a brilliant analytic mind, and he could make fine distinctions in his definitions. And in the book, I give some examples comparing how he would define a certain word to Johnson, and his definitions are going to be clearer. And that really was his great strength. And he had this analytic mind that could parse these fine distinctions. And that's what lexicography is really all about, is just being clear and direct and straightforward. And Webster could do that.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Other questions are certainly welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Something just as we have now about 5-6 minutes left, I wanted to make sure we talk at least a little bit more about, and that's his involvement, Webster's involvement in early American politics. He was, as you say, he was a Federalist, so that puts him in that camp that we associate with Hamilton, Alexander Hamilton.
Yes.
Washington as well, although Washington tried very hard to peer neutral. He was in that camp as well, as opposed to Jefferson and Madison and a number of guys who were on the other side. In any case, he had these strong Federalist ideas that had to do with the importance of a strong central authority, the idea of national unity. Some of that, at least, ended up actually being incorporated into the Constitution.
Yes, that's a part of Webster's legacy that's been lost. And in 1785, Webster was about 26, and he thought he knew what was wrong with America. He didn't like the Articles of Confederation, and Webster was very arrogant, and he always thinks he knows everything, and he was absolutely right. And he wrote a pamphlet called Sketches of American Policy, in which he critiqued the Articles of Confederation, and he said that we didn't have a strong enough central government. Our confederation is but a cobweb, he said. And he takes this pamphlet to George Washington, who's then the first farmer. And that's how my book starts, with him having dinner at Mount Vernon. And he tells Washington what to do to fix the country. And Washington, during this dinner, is, in my view, kind of nervous because Washington's not a policy guy. And Washington takes the pamphlet, but he respects Webster. Because Webster is a Yalie, James Madison is a Princeton guy, and John Adams is a Harvard guy, and Washington doesn't have a college degree, but he takes Webster's pamphlet and says, "Thank you very much," and he says, "Okay, I'll give it to Mr. Madison as soon as possible," and Madison looks at it, and Madison is going to incorporate some of the ideas from Webster's pamphlet. The pamphlet is both a diagnosis of what's wrong with America. We don't have a strong enough central government. And it also has some practical ideas, and one of those ideas is that we need something like the presidency. And again, this really isn't known that Webster helped with the Constitution, and he's interested in doing for American politics exactly what he did for American language. What he does for the American language with the speller is gets rid of provincial dialects. And for our nation as a whole, he's interested in getting rid of the conflict between the states. We had, you know, our government was at a standstill. Talk about gridlock in the 1780s. It was the ultimate gridlock. We couldn't do anything. And Webster wants to get rid of those provincial ruptures and unify us as a nation. So he does that with the sketches. And then 1787, he goes to the Constitutional Convention, and as soon as George Washington gets there, he knocks on his door. Webster isn't a delegate. He's there as a journalist, and he advises Washington. And in the fall of 1787, he writes a pamphlet in 2 days, right after the convention ends. And that pamphlet is then sent around the entire country, and historians have compared that pamphlet to the Federalist Papers. It may actually have been more influential. I mean, the Federalist Papers are very sophisticated and are brilliant works of theory. Webster's is kind of a simple and straightforward document, but it was available right away in October of 1787 and was passed around the country and was critical in getting the Constitution ratified by the states. And then Webster also works closely with Hamilton and Washington in 1793, when he becomes the editor of New York City's first daily newspaper. Washington is interested in staying out of a war with England, but some Americans, the Jeffersonians, want to ally with France, and Webster helps with this policy of neutrality by publishing a lot of documents. And this is New York City's first daily newspaper. It comes out 5 days a week. Alexander Hamilton later starts the New York Post, the oldest continuously published daily, in 1801, because he and Webster have a fight in 1800, and that's the fight that splits the Federalist Party and allows for Jefferson to be elected. Webster hates Jefferson, as do many of the Federalists, but between 1785 and 1798, when he leaves New York City to become a full-time lexicographer, he's really a major player on the national stage.
We have just about a minute. You talked earlier about how after Yale he was a school teacher, and that gave him an opportunity to see a lot of things that he thought was wrong with the way schools were organized at the time, and that he felt that there was this need for the book, which he the speller, which he then did. That made it possible for them. He made a lot of money from that, so then he could devote himself to the dictionary. And maybe for various personal reasons he would have wanted to take on a project like that. But was he, do you think that he was actually conscious of what sort of effect both of those books would have on the country and their making a contribution to this project of trying to, you know, do the make the unum out of the pluribus?
Yes. Throughout his whole life, that was a guiding principle. I mean, he really saw himself as America's pedagogue. And he, after he moved to New Haven, he also wrote a big encyclopedia for children. And he really wanted to inculcate a sense of patriotism and national identity in the coming generations. And that really was part of his obsession. What's so fascinating is that he himself was a man full of contradictions, and he was a kind of fragmented person. But in many ways, he's given us the glue that unites us, even though he himself would be contradicting himself all the time. But he was very conscious of that mission, and he also saw that as kind of his brand. He felt that if he could nationalize language, that would help him sell more books. So that mission came from his heart, but also was motivated by his pocketbook.
Our guest, Joshua Kendall, is the author of The Forgotten Founding Father, Noah Webster's Obsession and the Creation of an American Culture, published by Putnam. He's also author of an earlier book about Roget, the man who made the thesaurus. We talked about that as part of our afternoon magazine program a number of years back. That's on our web archive. You'd like to listen to that. It's will.illinois.edu. And, of course, if you want to read the current book, you can head out to the bookstore or wherever you buy books, and you can find it. And, Mr. Kendall, thanks very much for being with us.
Oh, it's been a pleasure.
You've been listening to a program from the Focus Archives. Many of our past shows, along with local news features, are available on our website anytime that you're ready to listen. Just go to will.illinois.edu. At this point, we'll take our usual break for news, and then Focus will continue, so please stay tuned.
Support comes from Subaru of Champaign County, located on Route 45 in Savoy. Dedicated to preserving our planet, the Subaru Assembly Plant in Lafayette, Indiana, achieved zero landfill status, with nothing from its manufacturing efforts going into a landfill. It's part of what makes a Subaru a Subaru. SubaruofChampaign.com or 352-4700.
In this tough economy, many homeowners are postponing plans to put their houses up for sale. For military families, that's a rare luxury.
They are not able to sell their homes, they have orders to move, and their house is underwater, and they just don't know what they're going to do.
Economic realities facing troops and their families today on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Today from 4 to 7 on AM 580 and from 5 to 7 on FM 90.9.
At 3 minutes before 11 o'clock with this look at the commodity markets, I'm Tom Rogers sitting in for Dave Dickey. Wheat futures are heading up. They rallied for more than 1% and went up more than 1% this morning as an annual tour of spring wheat fields in the Northern Plains appeared to verify fears that production would fall short of expectations there. But the concerns about weather are easing with corn and soybean futures. They dipped as more rain fell on crops through the Midwest, aiding corn pollination and crop development among the beans. And as the dollar firmed and crude oil retreated, the prices are still heading downward a little bit. Right now, in Kansas City, the September wheat contract is up 8.5 cents at 7.89. December at 8.15 and a quarter, that's up 8.75 cents. In the Chicago wheat market, September is currently trading up 9 cents at 7.03 a bushel. December at 7.43, that's up 8.5, and March is at 7.76, up 8.5 cents. Downward swings in both corn and beans. September corn right now down 5.25 at 6.84 and a half. December at 6.83 and a quarter, off 3.5. March is down 3.75 at 6.95 and three quarters, and the May is at 7.02, down 3.75. Crude oil futures for September are down about $1 a barrel, $1 at 98.58. RBOB gasoline at 3.16 and 2 tenths, that's up 8 tenths. August soybeans are at 13.70 and three quarters, that's down 12 and a quarter cents. September down 10.5 at 13.69 and three quarters. November at 13.78, down 10 and three quarters. January at 13.87 and a half, down 11. Soybean meal for August is at 356.10, that's down 4.40. The September contract 358.70, down 4.60. August soybean oil 56.38, down 21, and the September down 24 now at 56.55. In the livestock, live cattle for August currently trading at 111.10 a hundredweight. That's down 60. August feeder cattle down 60 at 135.50. And lean hogs for August at $100.90. That's up 42.5. The lean hog contract for October down 45 at 91.25. On the stock markets, the Dow is down about 119 points at 12,383, down about a percentage point. NASDAQ down about 1.75% or 51 points at 2789. And the S&P 500 index down 17 at 1315. You're listening to WILL 580 AM and 90.9 FM HD3 Urbana, Illinois Public Media. Our forecast for